Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today is the last show, my last show of the year. And in that spirit, I really tried to make this a show that's going to have you on the edge of your seat through the entire thing. So I'm not going to tell you who's going to be on. No. So what I'm going to do is I'll quickly list who's going to be on, and then we'll jump into it right away. Towards the back end of the show, we're going to have Amanda Marcotte. She's a contributor to RHRealityCheck.org and the author of the blog Pandagon.net. And we're going to be talking with Amanda about the war on contraception that characterized 2011 in terms of the rights of women and the assault against women. And Amanda's been a frequent guest on the show, so we're really happy to have her back. Before that, we'll be talking with Bob Perry. Bob Perry is an author and longtime investigative journalist, and he's the editor of ConsortiumNews.com. We're going to be talking with him about the cables and reports allegedly leaked by Bradley Manning and their impact on a possible future war with Iran. But before that, and opening up the whole show, I'm really glad to welcome back Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and an immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild. And she happens to be the editor of one of the more important books, I think, that came out over the last year, and that is The United States and Torture. Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Michael. Good to be here.
Yeah. Well, we're going to jump into this because I want to get as much as I can out of the time we have allotted to us. And you recently wrote an article, Bradley Manning, Traitor or Hero, and it's appeared in Consortium News, Counterpunch, and a number of other places. And in it, you make the point that Bradley Manning's military hearing to determine whether he's going to face a court-martial for exposing U.S. war crimes what coincided with Obama's declaration that the war in Iraq is over. And you argue that there's more to this than might meet the eye on a first glance. So can you talk about that?
Well, yes. Obama proudly took credit for ending the U.S. military involvement in Iraq after trying for months to extend it beyond the December 31st deadline that Bush had negotiated with the Iraqi government. The negotiations broke down when Iraq refused to extend criminal and civil immunity to U.S. troops for their crimes. And actually, it was after seeing evidence of war crimes such as those that were allegedly leaked by Bradley Manning, including the video called Collateral Murder, that the Iraqis refused to give immunity to U.S. forces from prosecution for their future crimes. And when I spoke with the Iraqi ambassador to the U.N., Tariq Akrawi, in Vienna at a recent international human rights film festival, he told me that if they granted immunity to Americans, then they would have to do the same for other countries as well. And of course, they had granted immunity before to Americans, but now, of course, they see the war crimes that are revealed by these leaks allegedly by Bradley Manning, including what are called the Iraq war logs. Now, one of the things that Bradley Manning is alleged to have leaked is the video, as I said, called Collateral Murder. It depicts U.S. forces in an Apache helicopter killing 12 unarmed civilians and wounding two children. And there were two Reuters journalists who were among the dead. People then tried to rescue the wounded. They were fired upon and killed by this Apache helicopter, by the forces in the Apache helicopter. And to top it off, a U.S. tank drove over one of the bodies, cutting the man in half. Now, this is not just appalling. It also constitutes war crimes under the Geneva Conventions, and we have ratified the Geneva Conventions, which makes them part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And the Geneva Conventions prohibit the targeting of civilians, the preventing of the rescue of the wounded, and defacing dead bodies. So if Bradley Manning did what he is accused of, and if indeed it did contribute to ending U.S. involvement in Iraq, then in my opinion, he should be hailed as a hero and not tried as a criminal.
We're talking with Marjorie Cohn, law professor and author, about the impending court-martial of Bradley Manning, the soldier accused of leaking millions of documents exposing the nature of the U.S. war in Iraq and Afghanistan to WikiLeaks. You know, it's very interesting, Marjorie, and very important that you said alleged when you were referring to the things that Bradley Manning is accused of doing. Because right now, Bradley Manning has been treated as he's already guilty. He's facing 52 years. He's facing a charge that could have brought the death penalty, even though the government said they're not going to push for the death penalty. This is a very serious assault on Bradley Manning. And it's very interesting because at the same time as they're doing this very serious assault, they've also said that, well, really what Manning is alleged to have revealed were things that were already known and they didn't really do that much damage. But you make the argument, and I think right now you started to hit on it, this argument that what he did was he really did expose, if he did this, he really did expose and make concrete the massive inhumanity and savage war crimes that committed by the U.S. in the Middle East, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And one of the things you dug into that really got me was the Afghan war diary that I thought was incredible, because I think a lot, I don't know how many people really, you know, how widespread that is in terms of what was actually revealed in that, what difference it makes, and what it does to the lie that it doesn't really matter what Manning was alleged to have brought out.
Right. Well, I want to follow up on what you said, because President Obama months ago said that Bradley Manning broke the law. Now, the last time I checked, we have the presumption of innocence in this country. And so the president, the commander-in-chief, coming out and judging Bradley Manning guilty before he's ever been to trial, I think is very worrisome. He's facing life in prison. He could get the death penalty if a judge overrules what the prosecutor is asking for. So these are very serious charges. And at the hearing that lasted 7 days, it's called an Article 32 hearing. It's to decide whether there's enough evidence to send him to a court-martial, which is a criminal trial. There was evidence presented that he had leaked cables and documents. There was no evidence that this leaked information imperiled national security or that he intended to aid the enemy, because one of the most serious charges against Bradley Manning is aiding the enemy. And in some online chats that are attributed to him, he talks about he came across these things in a very non-secure area. Here is a private seeing classified information. And he wrote in one of these online chats, if you had free rein over classified networks and you saw incredible things, awful things, things that belonged in the public domain and not on some server stored in a dark room in Washington, D.C., what would you do? And he said he wants worldwide discussion, debates, reforms. I want people to see the truth, because without information, you cannot make informed decisions as a public. One of the things that I think needs to be mentioned is that when Obama declared U.S. Military involvement in Iraq over, he called the Iraq War a success. He called it an extraordinary achievement. He didn't say that it had been built on lies about mushroom clouds and non-existent ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq. And also, he didn't mention the plan for post-Saddam Iraq, which was drawn up months before the September 11th attacks. And former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill said that the plans, quote, were already being discussed to take over Iraq and occupy it, complete with disposition of oil fields, peacekeeping forces, and war crimes tribunals, carrying forward an unspoken doctrine of preemptive war, unquote. Now, Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, also defended the Iraq war. He said, I think the price has been worth it. So what is that price? Well, in addition to the nearly 4,500 Americans killed, the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed, the untold thousands of Iraqis and Americans wounded, the traumatic brain injury, the post-traumatic stress disorder, suicides, and $1 trillion that went down the toilet that could have prevented the economic disaster in this country. In addition to that, there is evidence of several war crimes which have not been prosecuted, and that includes the Haditha massacre, the Fallujah massacre, where U.S. forces killed 736 people, at least 60% women and children. It includes the newly revealed war crimes by the Army's lethal warriors in Al-Dura, Iraq, with where insurgents are posed a threat. And this was reported by U.S. Army Ranger John Needham, where he presented photographic evidence that one man's brains were removed from his head and another man's face was skinned after he was killed. And I have seen these photographs, and they're unlike anything we've seen yet in any of these torture photographs. There's a new video out by Pulse TV and Maverick Media. It's called On the Dark Side in Aldura, A Soldier in the Shadows. And a link to that video is on my piece on Consortium News that you mentioned. Now, what happened after that? That was in 2007. CBS reported that they had obtained an Army document from the Criminal Investigation Command that suggested an investigation into these war crimes allegations. The Army's conclusion, the offense of war crimes did not occur. So we have, and we have war crimes, and these are documented in my book about the Bush administration. It's called Cowboy Republic. War crimes by American troops in Qaim, Tal al-Shal, Mukaradib, Mahmoudia, Hamadia, Samarra, Salahuddin, Ishaqi, and that was only up until my book was published in 2007. So we have unbelievable numbers of war crimes, and the orders, and this is in the Rules of Disengagement book, orders coming from the top. It was like a free fire zone, like we saw in Vietnam. Shoot at anything that moves. And many of our soldiers who engaged in these war crimes, carried out these orders, many have committed suicide, some have PTSD. But the bottom line is that the leaders of the Bush administration and their legal mercenaries, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, and the other lawyers, have not been investigated. In fact, Barack Obama has made sure they will not be investigated for the torture, which is also considered a war crime, and these other war crimes. And if Bradley Manning, instead of exposing war crimes, had committed them, he would be a free man today. And that irony, I think, is something that should disturb all of us.
Exactly. That is a terrible irony. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Marjorie Cohn about Bradley Manning and the hero or traitor, and hero or villain even, and it's a question of here of what Marjorie's arguing is that Bradley Manning, if he did what he is alleged to have done, should be hailed as a hero for all of humanity. You know, Marjorie, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is that instead, when you bring that up, and it's really, this irony was something that was really, really weighing heavily on my head, you know, to think about this, about Manning facing all these charges, possibly facing death, all this other stuff, and doing that while these other major war criminals, not just the soldiers that carried these things out, but the people who were actually pulling the levers and sending off the orders and setting the atmosphere, they walk free and are celebrated. And at the same time, Bradley ends up in a prison, which, you know, people don't, I don't, you know, I know a lot of people have heard about the inhuman conditions he was living in, but I don't know how much people understand that actually both Amnesty International and the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, have expressed great concern about his treatment in prison. And it was really very heavy that Mendez himself has been blocked from even having the ability to have a confidential discussion with Manning. And since he hasn't, since U.S. said he couldn't have that kind of confidential discussion, Manning decided not to see him. You know, it really does say something about the treatment that Bradley Manning has been receiving in terms of what's being set, the atmosphere that's being set around a trial and in society at large.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because he was in been in military custody for 18, 19 months now. The first 9 months he was in a military brig in Quantico, Virginia, where he was held in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement, as documented in the book United States in Torture, constitutes torture because it can lead to hallucinations, catatonia, suicides. And he was, and then to add insult to injury, I guess you would say, he was stripped naked and paraded in front of other inmates to humiliate him for no other reason. And it wasn't until there was an outcry, including by 250 law professors, I'm proud to say, and including myself, that we got the attention of the White House, and he was moved to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where he is not being held in torturous conditions. Now, keep in mind that Bradley Manning was a 22-year-old kid when these leaks were alleged to have happened, and all of a sudden he finds himself, and he's had all kinds of psychological issues, sexual identity issues that have been coming out in his defense, and all of a sudden he finds himself in solitary confinement, stripped naked, sleeping in like a gunny sack, even though the one leading psychiatrist said there was absolutely no reason for this. He made some kind of flip comment about, you know, what do you think? The guards had been harassing him, and he made a flip comment about, what do you think? I'm going to kill myself with my flip-flops. And then after that, he was subjected to this treatment. And, you know, another thing I think needs to be mentioned is that people generally, I think a lot of people think, many people think probably, that Dan Ellsberg was a hero for leaking 7,000 pages of documents and exposing the government's lies and helping to end the Vietnam War. And yet, according to Dan Ellsberg himself, the same things were being said about him at the time that are being said about Bradley Manning today. And many people say, well, it's different. Bradley Manning leaked many more things. Well, the documents that Bradley Manning is alleged to have leaked were classified. They were not top secret. The 7,000 pages that Ellsberg leaked were top secret. And so in that sense, the Ellsberg's leak was much more serious. And he went all the way up to the Supreme Court. He was facing life in prison as well. So I think it's important that I think history will record that if Bradley Manning did what he is accused of doing, regardless of what happens in his court-martial, and he will be court-martialed, that he did a great service to this country and to people all over the world who have been victims of the United States military activity in countries where we don't belong, including torture and abuse and war crimes.
All right, Marjorie, now we have about 2 minutes for this last question, and I'll be quick with the question. You already cited Bradley Manning's statement that if you had free rein over classified networks and you saw incredible things, awful things, things that belonged in the public domain and not on some server stored in a dark room in Washington, D.C., what would you do? You know, and I kept thinking about that as I was reading your article and thinking about the article afterwards. And, you know, it really does seem that there needs to be, you know, you saw one thing, like Ethan McCord was one person who actually saw that that video, that the collateral murder video, and recognized himself as being the soldier that went to try to rescue the children and has dedicated his life to speaking out against this. But that seems to be something that my take on Bradley's statement is that that's actually a call that should be listened to by many, many people here in the U.S. and around the world in terms of stepping up and calling this stuff out. What's your take on it?
I agree. And in fact, there is, you know, even though we have a so-called voluntary military, we don't have the draft anymore. We refer to it in rules of disengagement as the poverty draft, because many people that don't have alternatives in terms of education and jobs are lied to, pressured by military recruiters, and find themselves going back 2, 3, 4 times to Iraq, to Afghanistan. And there is much more resistance within the military than people would realize, even in this so-called voluntary military. And there are many resistance groups that are supporting Bradley Manning, people like Ethan McCord, who spoke out and criticized his own unit, the Marines from Camp Pendleton, who I was getting this confused with the Fallujah. But he did criticize the people in the Apache helicopter who were, and he wasn't there that day, but he still, spoke out and really brought that to people's attention, the collateral murder video. And if people have not seen that, just Google collateral murder video, and even collateral murder will bring that up. And it's outrageous. And you can hear the banter back and forth between the people in the helicopter with their supervisor, who doesn't even see what's happening on the ground, saying, look, we got that bastard. And it's really quite alarming, I guess, to say the least. And mm-hmm. You can actually see war crimes being committed. I mean, there's evidence of war crimes. People have reported them, but this is concrete evidence. And I also urge people to watch this new video, On the Dark Side in Al-Dura, A Soldier in the Shadows. I'll give you the URL. It's http://vimeo.com/ 337-55968, 337-55968. It really needs to get out into the public discourse. People need to see. This is most of this video is John Needham's father talking about what happened. John Needham is dead now. It's a very compelling story, but the pictures of this torture that we've never seen before will just really strike anger into the hearts of Americans when they see what was done in our name.
Okay. Thank you very much, Marjorie. I really appreciate you coming in today.
My pleasure, Michael, sure. And I hope next year is better than last year.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Let's make it that way, all right?
Take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Marjorie Cohn, a professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild and editor, one of the editors of this fantastic book called The United States in Torture. We've been talking about the Bradley Manning case, Traitor or Hero. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was Tom Waits with Lie to Me. Okay, and that's sort of where we're moving into with this next discussion. I'm really happy to be welcoming back to the show Robert Perry. Bob is an author, a longtime investigative journalist, and the editor of ConsortiumNews.com, and he's been writing quite a bit on Consortium News about the Bradley Manning case and how it plays out, its influence, and what it has to do with the situation in the world today, and especially with the growing threat of war in Iran. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. In your article, you talk about how Bradley Manning's alleged exposures have importance beyond the immediate exposure themselves, but also very much they're important in relation to the importance of the ground truth, you call it, in assessing issues of war and peace. Can you explain what you're talking about there?
Well, I think it's one thing for people to be told something in a general way. Sometimes that is done in the U.S. press, where, for instance, as Marjorie was talking about, it's one thing to have a reporter say there was an incident in Baghdad where 11, 12 people were killed in a clash with an American helicopter that fired on them. It's another thing to actually see it, and that certainly drives home the reality of this kind of atrocity, this kind of the price we pay in these kinds of wars, more so than any words can do, even if they're well done by the press corps, and often they're not. But the point is, I think people got from the detail in what Manning is alleged to have released to WikiLeaks, the kind of detail and precision of what was happening and how, and in terms of how people were actually being impacted. There were cases of rape, for instance, that were described in much more horrific detail than you would have gotten if you just read some reference to some of those cases in the New York Times. So I think in that sense, there's ground truth. But also in the sense of ground truth, there are details that make other issues, that shed light on other issues. And a point I make in this article is that in relation to the Iranian case, which is now heating up, there's evidence that is released in these cables regarding who the new leadership International Atomic Energy Agency is. There's detail about how the U.S. essentially engineered a change in the leadership of the IAEA. So when you're hearing all these stories, including the New York Times lead editorial, which make reference to these claims about Iran's nuclear program from the IAEA, it is useful to know that the United States, and to some degree Israel, were involved in placing the new leadership in charge of that agency, and that agency has, and that leadership has made clear that it is willing to work hand in glove with the United States and with Israel in relation to Iran. So, having that kind of knowledge, which you can get from these cables, but otherwise you wouldn't, can shed light on what you should be really concerned about or when you should be suspicious. That kind of detail is very important.
Yeah, you know, and it's very important in terms, especially in terms of the stuff that you're saying. It's really interesting when you think about, and I know you've spent a lot of your life actually railing against the big media, the mainstream press, all of the stuff, even as you were, you know, you had actually had your own experiences in it and paid a price for revealing the truth about certain, you know, the Iran-Contra affair, other things, you know. Then you talk about this article that you have that we're talking about now, America's Debt to Bradley Manning, which people should really check out. It's at consortiumnews.com, and it's in a really fascinating article, really important article. And we'll get back into some of the particularities you mentioned. But I thought that actually there were links to other articles that you had written exposing the role of big media and a repetition of the official story around Iran that actually went along with, but actually promoted a lot of falsehood, a lot of lies, a lot of shady material, and ignored things that actually cast doubt on the official stories. And so all this stuff that all they had to do, you would think, would to go back and look at what Manning was alleged to have released, and they could say, there might be some tie-in here with what happened in Iraq and the whole idea of weapons of mass destruction. And boy, we were taking that time, but, you know, as opposed to, you know, they were actually participants in it. But it really is, this time, it seems, actually knowing what we know about what happened in Iraq, what you've laid out about the role of big media, and it's really indicative of, we better wake up and we better recognize what the media is and what it's doing, because this is really horrible.
Well, a big part of what happened with Iraq was that we believed, or at least some people believed, enough people believed, of false prophets, false storytellers who provided false narratives. And the narrative was that Saddam Hussein was crazy, that he'd been developing all these weapons of mass destruction, that he had links to Al-Qaeda, and there were various witnesses who provided this information. There were some people believed that the CIA analytical division would tell them the truth. Some people in Congress relied on the CIA's analysis, not realizing that the CIA had become deeply politicized. And so people trusted different outlets, including some of the mainstream outlets in the news media, to provide what people thought were checks and balances in terms of the information, that the information might be reliable because it came from these various trustworthy sources, like, say, the New York Times, even the New Yorker magazine, which went in pretty big on the Iraq propaganda. We learned later, at a tremendous expense to the country, and especially to the people in Iraq and the American soldiers who went over there, that we were deceived and we were essentially lied to in many cases. Now, the odd thing is that after having learned that, those lessons, the very, very much the hard way, the American people are being led in very much the same direction, somewhat different characters, although some of the same characters are there, regarding Iran. And the same basic narrative is being set up. You've got this crazy leader who wants to build a nuclear weapon and don't believe it when he says he doesn't, and so forth. And we're being told, now trust, if you don't trust the U.S. government here, but you can trust these different entities like the IAEA. And the IAEA, interestingly, was one of the skeptics about the Iraq war. So people say, well, we can trust the IAEA about this. And now they're pushing the idea that Iran is moving toward a nuclear bomb. What is missing here is the fact that after the director general of the IAEA, El-Baradei, this Egyptian, after he was the one who challenged George W. Bush's claims about Iraq's nuclear program, he is no longer there. His removal was engineered, and his replacement was engineered by the United States, and they put in a Japanese diplomat named Amano, who, according to these cables that are now public, that came out through the leaks, allegedly by Bradley Manning, that they show in detail how he was put in place, how he met with the U.S. officials, how he told them he was going to pretend that he was going to be critical of the claims about Iran at first, but, you know, don't really believe that, and then he was going to basically work hand in glove with the U.S. regarding its Iran policy, in terms of promoting the nuclear allegations. So here you have this guy in conversations with U.S. diplomats, and the U.S. diplomats also talking to Israelis who were meeting secretly with Amano. And what you see is a guy who is essentially asking for American money, as well as thanking the United States for its political support in getting him the job, and offering to be their propagandist. So here we have this evidence, which is laid out in these U.S. diplomatic cables. But when the New York Times or other news organizations deals with the IAEA and its new report about Iran's nuclear program, which is, frankly, I've read the report. It's a very lame report. It has very little new information and very little that challenges the position of the U.S. intelligence community that Iran stopped work on its nuclear program in 2003. Most of the information in this IAEA report predates 2003, but there are a few things afterwards. But what we need to know is this a reliable organization anymore? And the New York Times or the Washington Post and all the big media have ignored the fact that they have in front of them, they have access to these cables too, they have in front of them evidence that the IAEA has been compromised. Yet they don't tell the American people that.
You know, it's actually, as you're describing all this, it sounds like an episode of The Sopranos. Yeah, it's like, what are we talking about here? You know, one of the things that really got me in the exposure you do around the IAEA report and all the machinations going on around that is this Soviet scientist, what's his name, Danilenko?
Danilenko, right.
Yeah, I mean, that was astounding. I mean, some of the ways that, you know, that this the spin was put on us to actually ratchet up the whole idea that Iran is right on the verge. They brought in the villains from around the world to come in and they're really secretly working and they're getting, you know, conferences on how to build nuclear bombs from a bomb expert, you know. And then you find out from what you've revealed and what was revealed in these WikiLeaks documents is that who this guy is absolutely he makes industrial diamonds.
Right. And obviously, in the case of developing a nuclear bomb, there's a lot of science that goes into it, and things have dual purposes. So you can't always say, well, that one body of knowledge might not somehow bleed into another. But the evidence is pretty clear that Danilenko, while he was a Soviet scientist who had some connection to the nuclear program, the physicist, but that he specialized in this idea of this technology for creating micro diamonds for industrial purposes, and that's what he was in Iran for. Now, whether is it possible that the Iranians could have taken some of that technology and figured other things out? I suppose, but there really isn't evidence of it. And again, this is what we're going back to. This is almost parallel to the Iraqi situation. Was it possible that that Saddam Hussein might have hidden some cache of biological or chemical weapons? I suppose it was, but there was no evidence of it. But this idea that what we saw was that in the way the propaganda was played out around Iraq, there's a lot of spooky music that goes on, a lot of ha ha, you can't possibly believe they wouldn't do that, can you? Better to be safe than sorry. Vice President Cheney had that idea of the 1% doctrine, which was that if something was 1% possible, we had to assume it was certain, which is almost a definition of madness. You know, if we think that something is 1% certain, almost anything is 1% certain. So we'd be racing around all over the world launching wars. But so this is not serious stuff in the sense of how you deal with information, but it became the technique for selling the American people on going to war. We're seeing it replayed now with Iran. The same kinds of anything that has any possible interpretation that can be made in a very negative way, we do it. We ignore the context of who might be selling us information that is not good. As long as it fits the narrative of the of how Iran wants to build a nuclear bomb and go off and terrorize the world, we will buy into it. That's what's being done. And again, it's the major U.S. news media, which is acting in the exact same way it behaved on Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I understand it. I worked for AP, Newsweek, PBS. I understand how this sort of game works. If you're a journalist trying to maintain your job, the fastest way to lose your job would be to question the U.S. government's position on something like this, and then have it turn out that maybe Saddam Hussein had saved some botulism somewhere, and you would be portrayed as a dupe and a kind of a traitor. Your career would be over. Conversely, if you go with the PAC, as many folks did back in 2002 and 2003, even though you turn out to be 100% wrong, as happened, virtually nothing happens to your career. You just continue moving on. It's because, and you can always say, well, everybody thought the same way I did. We all were wrong, so none of us are wrong. So there is that safety in numbers as long as you're going along with the flow. But we're seeing the same thing repeated again. One could say we saw something similar with Libya, where the same kinds of propaganda themes were played through. It's sort of a repetitious way that Americans are lined up to support war. And the role of the U.S. press corps has been quite insidious and quite against the principles of journalism. This is not objective. This is not balanced or fair. This is an effort to slant the story in a way where the outcome is predetermined. That is, the American people are supposed to support these policies. That's where the U.S. media wants to go, as well as much of the government. And therefore, we're almost not able to trust much of what we're reading. And even when the facts are clear, as it is, say, in the case of the IAEA, where the documents are there, the evidence is there, the evidence is just excluded. It's left out of the press.
And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. Now, Bob, we have about 3 minutes for this last question, and I wanted to ask you this because it's right off of what you've just been saying. You know, the repercussions of all of this regarding war, the drumbeat for war in Iran, it seems to me is very real. And as you say in your article, the stage is being set. There's a cascading of allegations regarding Iran, and you argue that one provocative move could set loose something that won't or can't be stopped. Can we talk about that?
Well, sure. We're seeing now a buildup of tensions on all sides. The Israelis clearly have tried to make it clear that they're ready to go to war and in some cases want to in terms of attacking Iran's nuclear sites or suspected nuclear sites. The Iranians have declared that some of the sanctions being placed on them are so injurious that they consider them effectively acts of war and are threatening to even try to stop the commerce through the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S., especially in this political climate, although President Obama, I have to say, has been one of the more moderating elements in this. I think he doesn't really want to have this war happen, but he is facing tremendous pressure. There was a 100-0 vote in the U.S. Senate for ratcheting up these sanctions against Iran. The Republican presidential candidates, with the exception of Ron Paul, are all essentially calling for either war or in the case of Newt Gingrich, actually an invasion to have a regime change in Iran. So you have all these pressures coming to bear, and any one spark could now set off an explosion. If the Iranians feel that their economy is being badly damaged by an oil boycott, for instance, or an oil blockade, they might take action in the Strait of Hormuz that would force the American hand. If the Israelis decide that things have gotten too far in their view, they might try to launch a bombing raid and sort of pressure the Americans to join them. So there are a lot of ways we can see this war happening, and there are fewer and fewer ways to practically see people moving back from this abyss, especially amid the climate of propaganda that's being whipped up in the United States.
Right. Now, I'd have to put up for discussion for the next time we have you back on this question of Obama, because I am very concerned around this idea that people may still think that Obama doesn't really – something he's somehow not on their side in terms of wanting war. There is a question that he may have different strategic concerns going on in terms of how to actually best serve U.S. interests in the Middle East. But he's done some very vicious things. These you know, sanctions that have been unleashed against Iran are setting up a situation that's very similar to what they did to Japan before World War II. And then you have Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta on Amy Goodman's show talking about how the United States doesn't want Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. That's a red line for us, and it's a red line for the Israelis. If we have to do it, we'll do it. She asked him, what do you mean by that? He says, if they proceed and we get intelligence that they're proceeding with developing a nuclear weapon, then we'll take whatever steps are necessary to stop it. To me, that's very chilling. And when Obama says everything's on the table, I think we got to take that serious. But that's a discussion for another visit, Bob, which we will have you back to talk about that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today, too, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com, and you can catch his article on Bradley Manning, The Debt America Owes Bradley Manning, at ConsortiumNews.com. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Amanda Marcotte from RHRealityCheck.org.
opened a bank account when I was 9 years old. I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I'd saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room, playing with the toys. And I am here to exercise my freedom of choice.
All right, that's Ani DiFranco with Lost Woman. And I wanted to, people should really listen to that whole song. It's a very, very, very good song, very important song. And I think it's really fitting that it introduces this segment of the show. I'm really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Amanda Marcotte. Amanda's a contributor to rhrealitycheck.org and the author of the blog pandagon.net. And we're going to be talking today about 2011, a year of war against contraception. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You know, you start your article off talking about 2011 being a year marked by amped up aggression from the anti-abortion, anti-women goons in society. My words. Give us a quick overview, contextualize this, and then we'll dig into some of the particulars. What do you mean?
Oh, it's almost hard to really summarize it quickly because it was such a bad year. Almost over 1,000 bills were introduced in state legislatures restricting reproductive rights. There was an attempt to defund Planned Parenthood that went all the way to a federal budget breakdown. There were amped up attacks on Gardasil, the HPV vaccine. There was a personhood amendment in Mississippi. There's been defunding of family planning on state level, family planning clinics on the state level. And then we ended the year with the Obama administration caving on the issue of whether or not emergency contraception should be sold over the counter with no restrictions. So it was an ugly bloodbath of a year.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, and reading your article really drove that home. I mean, it's, you know, you see these, and I'm someone who pays attention to what's going on, and when you see it as it's coming along one by one, or you read various reports about things happening, you don't realize what a cascade this is of assault on women. That's just incredible that's what's happened here. Why don't we look at some of the particular things on, you say the war on contraception went from skirmishes to an all-out war. You know, why don't we talk about that, and then we can look at some of the particulars of this.
Yeah, I would definitely say that prior to, the way I would frame it is that the anti-choice, anti-abortion movement has never really been fond of contraception. If you actually go into their circles and listen to them talk to each other, they use terms like the contraceptive mentality to denounce people who use contraception. They've never really been for it. That's why they supported abstinence-only education, which is basically anti-contraception propaganda. But they also have always been aware that contraception is really popular in the United States, and going on an all-out assault on it would probably not be to their benefit. So they've always held back a little. For some reason this year, they just decided to amp up the abuse of contraception. It's kind of hard to guess exactly why, but I think there's just it's part of a larger sort of right-wing surgence of radicalism.
You mean they actually are foaming at the mouth and charging in every direction, trying to lash out and bring women back to enslavement? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to be clear. Well, let's talk about some of this. You list about six different categories, and you talk about the Planned Parenthood federal budget standoff, which I thought was extremely important in terms of that was the thing that almost opened up the year.
Yes, there was a twofold thing. Obviously, the Republicans who were elected in 2010 were eager to do a retread of a federal budget standoff and threatening to shut down the federal budget. What was it wasn't surprising that they did that. What was surprising was that they decided to make the fight over Planned Parenthood, of all things, which has been funded along with all other family planning, subsidized family planning clinics in the country, with a Title X fund, which sort of helped low-income women afford contraception as well as just reproductive health care. And what they basically did was told President Obama that if he didn't sign off on a bill that zeroed out Title X funding, that they would shut down the federal government over this, over the birth control pill, over condoms, over cancer screenings.
treating women with UTIs, things like that, just the sort of basic and non-abortion health care. The number one thing you need to understand about Title X funding is none of it goes to abortion. So it had nothing to do with abortion. It was just an attack on contraception. Now, obviously, that didn't happen. Obama put his foot down and got his way on this, but it's alarming that it went to that level.
Well, you know, the thing that you talk about in terms of the funding of family planning on clinics on the state level, too. I mean, this thing, you know, I'm reading this, your article, and you talk about how, you know, in Wisconsin, they did, you know, you just mentioned cancer and cancer screenings. But in Wisconsin, they actually did add cancer screenings to the list of subsidized services that they're stripping from women of the state. This kind of thing really does point to the nature of this being not so much, you know, going after just contraception in its own right or by itself, but it's actually much more it's a spear aimed at women themselves, women as people and women as deserving of full human status. I mean, how can you defund cancer screenings, you know?
Well, it's a little surprising, but I think, you know, it's definitely one of those things where these clinics that provide this sort of subsidized reproductive health care are seen by the religious right as just sort of letting women be slutty, I think is the way they view it. They see all these reproductive health care that's outside of just delivering babies as somehow illicit, sexualized, grotesque, and should not be available to women because it just somehow encourages them to be sexually active instead of monogamous or celibate. And, you know, monogamous only with one man their whole life. So, I mean, in cancer screenings, you say, well, what does that have to do with it? Well, the thing is, cervical cancer, which Wisconsin cut out of it, is trying to cut out of its budget as a subsidized service, is caused by, a lot of the time, by the HPV vaccine, which is an STD. So it really does sort of fit their general view that any horrible thing that happens to you when you have sex, you have it coming.
Mm-hmm.
Even cancer.
Yeah. There you go. That's what I was. That's exactly what I was thinking. I mean, and it's to me, you know, what you were talking about before about all the ways they link all these things and the lies that they tell about what's going on in the family planning clinics, but also the lies that they tell about things like different methods of contraception. I mean, it's stunning to see this thing about even, you know, claiming the pill kills fertilized eggs, or, you know, all these things that talk about, you know, this is actually abortion and it's not contraception. And you know, it's chock full of lies and nobody seems to be exposing this.
Yeah, that was probably one of my biggest frustrations of the year, was when the Personhood Amendment in Mississippi, which would declare a fertilized egg a person, got on the ballot. Luckily, it was voted down. It was clear that the anti-choicers who put that on the ballot are hoping that they can get the birth control pill banned with it, and their argument is that the birth control pill works by killing fertilized eggs. It doesn't. It actually works by preventing ovulation. There's no evidence really to support the notion that it kills fertilized eggs, but by even introducing the subject, you had a whole bunch of people talking about it as if the pill worked this way. And it's frustrating because it shouldn't matter how the pill works. I don't think anybody whether or not it did work that way or not, it doesn't really matter. It still prevents pregnancy. But it's just sort of very frustrating to see them be able to make the pill somehow more controversial by suggesting that it works in a way that it doesn't. I don't really know what to do about that. I've seen even feminists suggest that that's how the pill works. And I just want to reiterate, it works by preventing ovulation.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Amanda Marcutt, contributor to RHRealityCheck.org and author of the blog Pandagon. And we're talking about 2011, the year of the war on contraception. Now, Amanda, one of the things that actually comes up very hard, too, in relation to this thing of how you're talking about, the point that you make, you drive home a lot in your article, and I thought this was a very important way of putting this, that the question of autonomy, the question of, you know, self-determination for women, the idea that women should be allowed to have sex and enjoy it when they want and with whoever they want, and the HPV vaccine, which this, again, is one of the cruelest things you could think of, designed solely to punish, you know, the movement against this is designed solely to punish people, women who want to have sex. You know, it's really incredible what's going on here. I mean, and you look at the people that are backing this. It should be ringing large, loud bells to people. Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, all these people who are denying or want to deny this vaccine to women on the basis of if they're having sex, they deserve to get this.
Yes, their claim, and the way they try to sort of soften that is they make the claim that young women won't have sex if they aren't protected against HPV, which there's been tons and tons of research that shows that getting vaccinated at 12 years old doesn't really impact your choice to have sex at 16, 17, 20, whatever. There's no reason to think that getting a vaccination against an STD that teenagers really don't even understand very well would have any impact on their sexual choices. But what it does is it prevents cancer. It not only prevents cancer against cervical cancer, it also prevents throat cancer. There's new evidence coming in that there's nearly as many men dying of throat cancer from HPV as women dying of cervical cancer. So there shouldn't be any kind of opposition to this, but that is the level of anger and anxiety about sexuality that there is out there. And let me reiterate, HPV is incredibly common. Even if you only have one partner in your life, you're probably going to get it.
Let's move on to one of the biggest things that you've listed, and that is the Plan B debacle. And tell people what Plan B is, and then what the hell is going on with that?
Plan B is a one-dose pill that you can buy over-the-counter if you're 17 or older. You can take it after you have sexual intercourse if the condom breaks or you had unprotected sex otherwise. If you take it within 72 hours, it doubles the chance of avoiding pregnancy because it suppresses the ovulation. The sooner you take it, the better. And what happened was under the Bush administration fought making this pill available tooth and nail. They fought making it available over the counter without a prescription. When they did finally do that, they fought to have all these age restrictions put on it. A federal court has already found that there shouldn't be any age restrictions put on it. The FDA decided under the Obama administration to go ahead and rescind all the age restrictions that they were going to put on it. And then at the last minute, caving into pressure from the Christian right, I suspect, Kathleen Sebelius of the HHS, the secretary, came in and basically did something that's never been done before, which is overruled the FDA's decision on how to regulate a drug. The HHS has never done this before. And she basically said that they cannot make it available over-the-counter with no age restrictions. The reason that this is a problem, I think, should be obvious, which is that if a 15- or 16-year-old has unprotected sex, having to go to her parents or to a doctor to get a prescription and then having to get that prescription filled, not only are a lot of teenagers just simply not going to do that, but also it adds days, hours to the time between when the unprotected sex happens and when you can take the pill, increasing the odds that they're going to get pregnant. If you could just buy it over the counter, it would be just tremendous benefit.
Now, Amanda, we have about 1 minute, and I want to get your response to this real quick. The UN Special Rapporteur of the Human Rights Council issued a report on the connection between reproductive health and human rights and concluded that legal restrictions on access to reproductive health services serve to systematically deprive women of full participation in society. What do you think?
Well, I would hope that that's obvious. I mean, nothing is harder on women or few things are harder and more consistently difficult for women to get over than having to handle unintended pregnancy. It's if you can't get an abortion, especially, you know, having children when you're not ready is a humongous financial burden. It's a humongous time burden. It's linked to dropping out of school. It's linked to dropping out of the workforce. It's linked to all sorts of negative outcomes. And it's not that women aren't going to have children. It's just a matter of giving women the right to say when they have children. It makes a huge difference.
All right, Amanda, we're going to have to wrap it up. But let's end like we did last year around this time with, you know what I think? I think we all got to get out there and push for abortion on demand and without apology and free. And free contraception to everyone who wants it. It would be a hell of a better world if women are liberated and able to take full participation in society for real. So, Amanda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, talk to you again soon. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've been talking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a contributor to rhrealitycheck.org and author of the blog Pandagon at pandagon.net. And I just wanted to let people know, if you think back on the theme of today's show, and it's actually a theme if we're entering into the new year and we're looking back on the past year and we're looking at the state of the world, there's something that we all ought to keep very firmly in mind, and that is fact one. The world as it is now is extremely horrendous. It's a horror. And no one can really deny that. Anybody who's got any sense or any conscience can ever deny that. But a more profound fact is that the world doesn't have to be this way. It can be a whole different way, but that's going to take work to make it different. And that's one of the reasons why I keep referring people to Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and encouraging them to check out what it is that he's been working on, what he's saying, his work, the speeches, his books and whatnot. Because Avakian has spent the vast majority of his adult life hammering away at the problems that stand between us, the world that we live in today, and tomorrow, the world that we could be living, that we should be living. A world where each of us will give as much as we're able to, and we'll all get back what we need to live a life worthy of human beings, a life full of dignity that includes things like the creativity, the ability to know the world as it is, all of these things that can come together and be all very critical aspects of a full human life. That's what we're aiming for, that kind of world, a world free of exploitation and oppression. So on that note, I want to thank my production assistant today, Henry Carson, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song that, you know, it's just always been dear to my heart because of the kind of very innocent but very defiant tone it sets. And that is "You Don't Own Me" from Leslie Gore.